Now, this is a typical example of Chinese Taoist wisdom in Buddhist dress. Ma, in Chinese, ma means horse. And Huineng, when he was teaching in his 40s, when he was in his prime, as we say, said that there was a tradition that the 27th Indian patriarch, the last native Indian patriarch, whose name I think was something like Prajnaratna, which means night wisdom in Sanskrit, Prajnaratna had had a clairvoyant insight where he said that the Dharma would go to China in that a strong stallion there would trample the books of the Dharma. Well, Ma, being the family name of Ma Tzu, in a way he was a horse. And it's strange because he's the only patriarch in all of Buddhism, India or China or Japan or anywhere, he's the only master whose family name is incorporated in his Dharma name. He keeps his name, Ma, like my family name is Weir. And Ma Tzu is an honorific name, meaning the great horse, literally. The masterful horseman, Dao Yi, of the unified way. And Ma Tzu, Dao Yi, lived into the late 780s, almost to 790 AD. And he's the one who reconstitutes what is called the lineage, and makes literally the lineage that becomes the Rinzai sect, by saying, out of all of the infinite numbers of lineages that there can now be, there should be at least one that does what Huineng did. And so Ma Tzu takes on specifically, looks specifically for a disciple, for someone to pass this particular regathered out of the ether, lightning on, and he finds a very exotic, peculiar Chinese name, whose Dharma name, Buddhist name, is Huang Po. And Huang Po is really exotic. And Huang Po, when he receives this from Ma Tzu, he receives the power to bestow this lineage in the sense that he breaks through the fictive shell of the everyday and reveals the magma of the Dharma personality, but that the Dharma personality has to be full grown first. And so it's an odd situation where you have to challenge someone to grow naturally and in a prosaic way, and at the same time prepare them to be radically and cosmically cracked. And you have to do both at the same time. And this is why the choreography of that particular lineage is so very difficult, because almost nobody can qualify for that. Almost nobody can be so ordinary and so mundane as to be boring and at the same time instantly turn on a dime at some time in their life and be the most exotic, radical intelligence on the planet. It's almost impossible to do that, to find someone that fits. But Huang Po, being one of those characters himself, found the bright person. His name was Lin Chi. And it's Lin Chi, whose name translated means Rinzai in Japan. But before he can do this, there's an interesting kind of lineage that happens, that Huang Po picks a monk named Hui Hai to prepare this interface with Lin Chi. And so there's a very exotic double take that happens. It's typical Taoist magician juggling going on. So after Huineng, there comes a pattern of Ma Tzu, Huang Po, Hui Hai, and Lin Chi. And this runs roughly from the 750s A.D. and the death of Lin Chi, who's the last in that pattern, dies around 866. So from about 850 to about 866 A.D., which coincides with the downfall of the Tang Dynasty, Chinese Chan Buddhism becomes a Taoist form, esoteric, as sublime as anything has ever been made in the world. And it becomes capable of being passed on like tarot cards in the hands of traveling gypsies. Nobody knows that this tremendous power is being passed on through common ordinary people. People for all the world look like country dolts, who are indistinguishable from country dolts, who are country dolts, but who have a cosmic trigger in them that at some time can be pulled and they turn into Superman. They rip off the Clark Kent mild-mannered reporter clothes and there they are. They have the original Buddha mind of someone who's seen through the whole cosmos. This produces, after the fall of the Tang, an interesting kind of an interplay in the Chinese Taoist tradition. They realize that there's always the possibility that a Taoist Superman is going to come out of the mountain someday, take the hayseed out of his mouth, and through a couple of magical words, take over everything. And this myth, this legend, causes a lot of consternation in Chinese history after that. And causes, in fact, in the 840s AD, a tremendous persecution of Buddhism. The emperor at that time, I think his name was Wei Qiang, goes through a tremendous persecution of Buddhism. He forces 100,000 Buddhist monks to go back into lay life, about 75,000 Buddhist nuns to go back. Oh, he does it in a very normal way. He says, all of those men and women who are having sexual relations with each other are no longer allowed to stay in the monasteries, but have to form families and start paying taxes. That all of the monks who now own property individually, you're going to have to pay taxes on them, and you're no longer a monk. So he beats them at their own game, in a way. But in this persecution, what is happening is that Taoism and Buddhism are being forced by royal decree to part, trying to part them, trying to take the Taoist tradition back into China. There are edicts that come down, and I had them singled out, and I don't know if I can find them right off the bat. I think I can find this one. This is from Enin's Travels in Tang China. The only reason we have a copy of this edict is because a Japanese traveler, Enin, E-N-N-I-N, was traveling in China and kept a diary. And the diary was kept in a monastery in Japan, and Edward Reischauer translated it about 30 years ago into English. Everybody was surprised that it even existed. 844 A.D., by imperial decree, along with certain Taoist priests supporting it. Here's some direct words that Enin copied down from the decree into his notebook. The Buddha was born among the Western barbarians and taught non-birth. Non-birth is simply death. He converted men to nirvana, but nirvana is death. He talked much of impermanence, pain, and emptiness, which are particularly weird doctrines. He did not understand the principles of spontaneity and immortality. Lao Tzu, the supreme, we hear, was born in China. He roamed about and spontaneously and naturally became transformed. He concocted an elixir and, taking it, attained immortality and became one of the realm of spirits and produced great benefit without limit. We ask that a terrace of the immortals be erected in the palace where we may purify our bodies and mount to the heavenly mists and roam around the nine heavens and with blessings for the masses and long life for the emperor, long preserve the pleasures of immortality. Now you can see the influence of religious Taoism here, as opposed to the philosophical Taoism, which is brought into Chan Buddhism. But what's opposed here is the theocratic structure of monastic Buddhism and the religious Taoism of the fakirs. That's what's opposed here. And escaping this war of the 840s in China is the Chan tradition. And the way that it escapes is through the masterfulness of Lin Qi. Lin Qi's personality, his incredible intellectual genius, and we have to use that term now, was the one who kept that thread, that tradition, if we can say, alive. And Chan Buddhism comes through this tremendous period, baptized by the fire. And this is typical. This is translated from Lin Qi's discourses, translated by Ruth Fuller Sasaki, the Institute for Zen Studies in Kyoto, 1975 publication. Followers of the way, don't accept what I state. Why? Statements have no proof. They are pictures temporarily drawn in the empty sky, as in the metaphor of the painted figures. Followers of the way, don't take Buddha to be the ultimate. As I see it, he's just like a privy hole. Both bodhisattvahood and arhatship are cankers and chains that bind one. This is why Manjushri tried to kill Gotama with his sword, and why Anglimaya attempted to slay Shakyamuni with his dagger. Followers of the way, there is no Buddha to be obtained. Even the doctrines, including those of the three vehicles, the five natures, and complete and immediate enlightenment, all these are but temporary medicines to cure corresponding illnesses. In no sense do any real dharmas exist. Even if they were to exist, they would all be nothing but imitations, publicly displayed proclamations, arrangements of letters, just for the time being stated that way. Followers of the way, there are a bunch of shave-pates, monks, who try to seek a transcendental dharma by directing their efforts inward. A great mistake. If a man seeks Buddha, he'll lose Buddha. If he seeks the way, he'll lose the way. If he seeks the patriarch, he'll lose the patriarch. Virtuous monks, make no mistake. I don't care if you understand the sutras and the shastras, if you're a king or a high minister, if you're eloquent as a rushing torrent, or if you're clever, or even wise. I only want you to have true insight. And so this is the lion's roar of Lin Qi, the tough guy, the inheritor of Hui Neng, who was so classically capable of setting the seed, of maturing it, breaking the shell. Lin Qi then finds himself capable and passing this on. And after Lin Qi, the nature of Chan Buddhism becomes radically split between a north and a south, between a northern group of people who say you have to study gradually through the sutras and through practice, and through the south that says it's a sudden enlightenment and you don't have to do anything special. It's the everydayness. But the esoteric Taoist understanding always is in that five-phase energy flow, that one has to have the true insight of being able to take your consciousness out of the job of styling life, of styling mind, of creating conditions in which you play a part of them, in which your flavor is in the structure, in the form of it. That when you take that out of play, then whatever is going on is still going on, but you're not woven into the pattern. So then increasingly, in the practice of that, you see that all of this is the same pattern, of the same pattern, that all of what is going on everywhere is of the same fabric of a single unity, but that you could not see that in any way if your person were a part of any of the weaving. And so the true man of Chuang Tzu, the Bodhisattva of the Prajna Paramita literature, coming together in Huineng and being raised to the fine art of breaking cosmic eggs in Lin Chi, transforms Buddhism into an esoteric Taoist tradition. And in a very real way, Huineng, like Lao Tzu, starts up the Taoist tradition again. And by Lin Chi's time, it's very much like Chuang Tzu again, that there is a philosophic Taoism, but now it's in the experience of Chan Buddhism. And we don't find in the Taoist tradition, after the fall of the Tang Dynasty, we no longer find the philosophic Taoism of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. It never again occurs in China. If you want that, you have to go back to Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. But instead, when the Sung Dynasty comes in, with the fall of the Tang, the sharpening of the Chan tradition, when the Sung Dynasty comes in, you for the first time have great ecumenical philosopher named Chu Xi. And Chu Xi, which we'll look at next week and compare him to the Chan Buddhists, Chu Xi for the first time develops what comes to be known as a thought matrix known as Neo-Confucianism. But Neo-Confucianism is Taoism and Buddhism and Confucianism all wrapped up together, all operating as a single unity and single harmony. I have a quotation somewhere. I don't know if I can find it. From Layman Pang, I think it was, who was asked whether there was any difference between Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism. And the answer was that in a superior person, when they're outside of the pattern and can see them for what they are, there's no difference. Because they are all a part of the same pattern. They're all part of the texture of reality, which is a pattern. But the perspective to be had is to find some way to integrate them together so that instead of there being many patterns before you, there's only one. And Neo-Confucianism will do what Chan Buddhism did, but will do it in the polar opposite way. Instead of taking the individual outside of all patterns to show you that there's only one pattern, Neo-Confucianism will teach you to stay in whatever pattern you're in and work all the others in so that they become one pattern within your experience. So that in the Sung Dynasty, very early on, the sophistication, the intellectual sophistication, will rise to the highest point that it's ever been in Chinese history. They will be so adept mentally that they will invent calculus some 600 years before the West has it, but it'll just be a Taoist mind training game, the kind of thing they would use the recluses would use for brilliant students to get them to discipline their mind. But they would never apply it, so there was never a technology that was informed by higher mathematics, but they had it, they were capable of it in the 900s. So we'll see next week the great genius of China in this this apex.
Him and instruct him instantaneously that there's no time lapse, there's no syllogistic causal order, but that he instantaneously knows, he understands that spiritual man, by looking, by the act of spiritually perceiving, understands, and his cognition is a recognition. And in this way, he remembers. And the arcane center, core of all this is for him to recognize himself, who he really is. he's not that image mirrored out there, or what someone thinks he is, or the occupation that he does, or the incidentals, but that he is a spiritual presence who is individual, who is recognizable, who is memorable. And thus, when he remembers himself, he then operates in the real world, in the real cosmos. And when he calls out, he calls the names of the angelic powers. That he is no longer limited, for instance, by the seven planets in a kind of an astrological way, or really an almost a Gnostic sense of the hebdomad of haimarmene, destiny, constraining man, and all these seven levels are holding him in, and he just being capable of puppet-like living out that destiny. He learns their names. Saturn, Trithemius uses the name Orophiel, Jupiter, Zachariel, Mars, Samael, the Sun, Michael, Venus, Aniel, Mercury, Raphael, the Moon, Gabriel. All these there in the steganographia. In the steganographia, give you a little description. This is from Dame Frances Yates, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition. She writes, an interesting example of applied magic. It's almost like we would speak today of applied science, technology, because he's thinking in the same way that we're thinking. Well, instead of calling it science, he calls it magia. And science comes from this. It's born out of this. There never was a science like we have now in the 20th century, because no one had the mind to comport in this way the last 300 years or so. An interesting example of applied magic or power magic is the steganographia of Johannes Trithemius, abbot of Spondheim, reprinted in 1606, but known in manuscript before that. I should say, he died in 1516. He corresponded with Luther, incidentally, among other people, who liked him. Liked the man, liked the ideas. The steganographia purports to be, and perhaps really is to some extent, about cryptography, or ways of writing in cipher. It is also, however, Kabbalistic angel magic. The first book is about summoning district angels, or angels that rule over parts of the earth, a geographical concurrence. The second book is about time angels, who rule, she says, the hours of the day and the night, but actually this timeline being, some of you who were in my Hellenistic lectures remember that after the Book of Enoch and the development in the 2nd century B.C., the development of the Essene esotericism about timeline beings, and this is the development from that. The third is about the seven angels higher than those that rule the seven planets. The planets rule destiny and rule you until you understand the names of the angels for whom the planets are operable symbols. And then man can call out for help in this way. Trithemius aims, she writes, at using this angelic network for the very practical purpose, she writes here, of transmitting messages to people at a distance by telepathy. In fact, Trithemius held quite reasonably and quite sanely that spiritual man should be able to communicate with any other spiritual person anywhere on the earth instantaneously. There should be no problem whatsoever, or anywhere that they are. Since he can contact the angelic presences that rule the planets, why not fellow beings in the spirit? And also that such a, he hopes to gain from it knowledge of, quote, everything that is happening in the world. That the world, at any given moment, is an integrated unity. And that the true movement of reality is the continuity of this unity. Not so much from moment to moment in time, but from eternity to eternity in any given moment. And that spiritual man then is masterful for the infinities of continuity. And this, of course, is just what Leibniz will say is one of the virtues of his universal language, the calculus. It allows man to think in terms of continuities and infinities with precision. And we do it every day now. Millions of people do. This was new once, and it was new in the mind of Trithemius about 500 years ago. He goes through the technical side of this science, very complex, pages and pages of elaborate calculations. And she goes on to describe this and so forth. And I have, as one of the slides, the title page of a reprint of Trithemius's great Steganographia, which was done in 1624. And it was the Rosicrucian reprinting of the Steganographia. With Francis Bacon and Augustus of Braunschweig, Lunenburg, and a number of other individuals in the 1620s who were hoping to amplify Trithemius' work at that time. But of course, the element that was lacking there in the 1620s was the just appreciation of the indelible need for mathematics. In the 1620s, the Rosicrucians like Flood and Mayer and Bacon and so forth were quite accurate, but they were unable to put it into effect, to make it an application of it, because there wasn't the insight that Trithemius had that you have to have a mathematic. And of course, in his day, he went as far as you could go. In Elizabethan times, John Dee would take up the angel magic of Trithemius. And when he was young, Dee was a mathematical genius and would also, especially like in the introduction to the translation of Euclid's Elements around 1571, about 100 years after Ficino translating the Corpus Hermeticum, is a very fine Elizabethan translation of Euclid, the progression of the training of the mind through geometry, beginning with a point, which is a point has no dimension, beginning with the infinity of the point. Euclid's very esoteric, Hellenistic thinker. But Dee's introduction to that, which is now translated, or reprinted, I should say, he wrote it originally in English, which in 1571 was amazing, because Latin was still the current language. But there's every appreciation that one has to have the mathematical language in order to make the application to the world. Otherwise, one is altruistically trapped in the intention and unable to apply it. That it's the language of the magus who makes it applicable to the world. And that once upon a time, there were sigils that could be used for this, but they weren't very precise. It took a very great magus to be precise with occult sigils. But with mathematics, one can be taught, millions can be taught, to use it with great precision. And of course, it would be later on, the man who, on the other end of the parentheses from Trithemius, Leibniz, really, who develops this. Maximilian wanted Trithemius in 1505 to write the history of the esoteric tradition from his family perspective. Leibniz was given that same office by the same noble family, the Braunschweig-Lunenburg family, who later on became the House of Hanover, and who became the kings and queens of England. There's all of this interplay. It's difficult for us to relate, though, to a man who spans both the kind of subject matter that you would find in this volume, Spiritual and Demonic Magic, from Ficino to Campanella, published originally by the Warburg Institute in London, and a book like this, The Mysticism of the Cloud of Unknowing, by William Johnston. It's difficult for us to get a notion until we begin to put into perspective for ourselves the kind of man that he was. Johnstone, in his final appendix to The Mysticism of the Cloud of Unknowing, in writing about the culmination of spiritual practice, not mysticism as a altruistic attitude, but the practice of it, the effective practice, ends with union with the divine. And that this is not a science fiction expectation, but that it happens around the world for all time. The testimony is there in any language you want to consult. He says here, the answer, it seems to me, is first of all, the historical evidence that people who incline to vertical thinking and those who devote themselves exclusively to discursive or logical thinking or horizontal thinking always have the greatest difficulty in understanding one another. That the syllogistic mind, the so-called logical mind, dealing with inference, moves along in trains of thought, horizontal. The mystic leaves at any point along that path and goes vertically and is interested then in ascension and is willing to accept that what he is going towards is unknown and that it takes spiritual courage because at a certain point in his ascent, not only is where he is going unknown, but where he has been, it becomes unknown. And he becomes suspended, as it were, between two unknowns out there all alone. That solitude has this eerie, practical, crackling reality at that point. But it's just there that the archetype of infinite unity rises and flames up in man because he is a spiritual being. And it's only in that suspension of all belief and all disbelief that the motion of the all becomes congruent with himself. And then he knows, then he understands. Trithemius was this kind of individual from a teenager. But he had the grit, as we would say, to try and find a way to understand how to see this in terms of universal history and in terms of a universal language and how the movement through history led to the development of this language. Somewhere along the way, maybe not in his time, but somewhere in the future, it would happen. And all that future generations needed to know was that the wisdom was buried archetypally within. And so, of course, the great mythological archetypal figure of Christian Rosenkreutz would come up. It would be a perfect blending of Trithemius and Trismegistus, their personalities together, and the arcane mythological history of the Hermetic tradition, and the implication that somewhere along the line will be revealed again to those who are sensitive, the exact truth of all of this, that the occult mystical language will become intelligible to them. They will be able to speak it. and that world history then will come true in the sense that the sine wave of development will have come back into its fullness. I have 12 slides which will show a few things, and I think maybe we should see those now.
Right there.
This is recognizable, a card from the popular tarot deck. And we have here an exoteric symbolism. That is, this symbolism is meant to train the mind to be sensitive in a way which we would technically have to think of in terms of signals and responses and reference, correspondences. We have to think in terms of systems, in terms of graphs, with this kind of symbolism. But there is a different symbolism. There is this kind of internal symbol. This is a page from Carl Jung's Esoteric, a Red Book. This is his only unpublished volume. Is that clear enough?
Yeah.
And here is Philemon standing on the dome of the rock in Jerusalem. This is an angelic presence within who comes to instruct from within and not dependent at all on correspondences or on a system. Instead of there being a system of correspondences, there is the certainty of spiritual unity, that one deals with infinity as the familiar intelligence and not with correlation. So that instead of having a mentality, one has mind. In the beginning of the first Hermetic teaching, the Primander says, I experience myself as a mind rising in vastness, and thus I am ready to learn. It's different from school. This you recognize from last week. This is Hermes Trismegistus from Solomon Trismegistus, the Golden Fleece, the alchemical presentation in 22 images of the progression of the quest for the red line, the alchemical transformation of the individual to his spiritual wholeness. And that figure is combined with all of the other figures on the title page so that we have a complete array, almost a mandala, as it were. This was as far as the pictorial esotericism could go. Trithemius changes this to language. To language where number and language come together, and that the emphasis is subtly changed from Neoplatonian thought to Neopythagorean thought. And with the movement in Trithemius, in his outlook, along with Reichlin, the Pythagorean view is the one that comes into play. And modern mathematics comes out from the Pythagorean phase of the Hermetic tradition. This is a page, I've got it in backwards. This occurs in one of the manuscripts that we have here in the PRS library. And this deals with the transformation of traditional esoteric imagery into correlated symbolic systems. This is a page, also in backwards, I'm sorry to say, from Reichlin's De Verbo Marifico, in which he is discussing the esoteric meaning in the name of Jesus in Hebrew. And he is saying that in the word, in the language, is the true esoteric understanding. That imagery is meant to train the mind from the material world to an understanding of correspondences, setting up the mind to a mature point, to where then the mind in its transformation can receive the internal symbols and translate them into a universal language. This is a page from the Book of Kells. This is a turning of visual imagery into symbolic words. It's not important to be able to read those words so much as to be able to respond to them in a spiritual way. That is, it isn't the sentences. In the Book of Kells, which is the Gospels, the four Gospels, there's no real emphasis on completeness or accuracy of text. It's an incidental. But it is the spiritual symbolic language that's being taught by this arrangement here. So that one goes into the infinite complexities, realizing that it's all part of a unity. And in the Book of Kells, we have symbols of angelic presences. Also here, we have an icon. This is a Russian Orthodox icon of an angel. This is an angel in the Book of Kells. Throughout the entire tradition of the West, especially in Christianity,